This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
People can deny climate change, but just like King Canute of old, nobody can stop the rising seas. Author and journalist Jeff Goodall tells all in his new book, The Water Will Come: Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Jeff Goodall is a journalist's journalist. I've read his work for years in places like Rolling Stone magazine. In the earliest days of this program, in 2006, I interviewed Jeff for his book, Big Coal. He's also the author of How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering, and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate. Jeff Goodall, welcome back to Radio EcoShock after all these years.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Rising seas is the biggest story ever reported. Could that be true?
The biggest story ever reported? I don't know, but it's certainly going to reshape our world in very profound ways that I kind of try to grapple with a little bit in this book.
Well, on Radio EcoShock, we've run a series of interviews on growing heat deaths, with more to come. It seems like climate change, rising seas, and killer heat are in a race for public attention. How do you see the importance and impact of these two climate sides of the picture, if you will?
Well, you know, as you know, climate change is going to have and is already having lots of different impacts in different ways. You know, compared to killer heat waves, which are very much a, you know, obviously people die during killer heat waves. It's a very much a story about human mortality and the things that we can do to mitigate that to the degree that we can with better housing, better air conditioning, better all kinds of ways of dealing with heat. Sea level rise is really a story about infrastructure and about housing and real estate. And ultimately, of course, people will have to move from the coast. But the real risk for sea level rise has to do with is kind of an economic risk about the kind of incredible economic damage that will be caused in places like Miami and Texas and New York and Boston. Of course, it will have big human impacts in places like Bangladesh and Africa, which I talked about in my book. But the economics of it are going to be really devastating.
People can die from sea level rise in the sense of storm surge. We saw it with Hurricane Sandy, where the waters just rushed in. I think that's probably the only really fast implication of sea level rise that I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, and it's really an important point. I mean, sea level rise makes storm surges, makes hurricanes more deadly, because as the seas get higher, that just is, you know, piled on top of whatever storm surge is coming in. So if you have 3 feet of sea level rise, you're going to have a 3 foot bigger storm surge. And that can change, a 9 foot storm surge into a 12 foot storm surge, which has huge, huge implications.
I'm wondering, Jeff, did you happen to read Dr. Peter Ward's book, The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps?
I did. I read it a whole bunch of books, and I did read that one, yes.
Yeah, pretty good. Well, look, sea level rise, that term, it kind of assumes that there's just one thing, but in fact, there are several different aspects to this, and I'd like to dive into them with you, as I'm sure you do in your book. One of those things is going to be the way that sea level affects agriculture. You get an extra dose of seawater. They call it seawater intrusion, I guess. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that's a really big problem that it's good of you to bring up and often goes unnoticed. So one of the first things that happens in many places that have sort of a porous aquifer, a freshwater aquifer, including places like South Florida, Bangladesh, the Pacific Island states that have a lot of agriculture, is that the salt water gets into either directly into the fields by flooding, you know, the lowlands. And as we all know, salt water is devastating for all kinds of crops. You basically can't grow crops with even small amounts of salt in the water. But it also is very troubling when you get saltwater intrusions into the aquifers that are used for irrigation. So it doesn't have to literally flood the ground. It can just small amounts of salt water intruding into the underground aquifers render those aquifers basically unusable for agriculture. So one of the things that you're going to see happening as we even get modest levels of sea level rise, and it's in fact already happening in the Pacific Islands, is the salinization of freshwater aquifers, which has huge implications for agriculture and, of course, for drinking water also.
Well, we don't have to head very far over to the Pacific to find that. I've been reading about saltwater intrusion into the Central Valley agricultural system stretching all the way from San Francisco up to Sacramento. And what's happening there is that the farmers have pumped out so much groundwater that that's allowing the seawater to start to come in, and it will start to affect food production in America's food basket.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what's going on there. You know, the Delta region of California is one place that not a lot of people associate with sea level rise because it's, you know, relatively far from the actual coast. But that's one of the things that happens as the water rises. It pushes back into deltas and into rivers. And in fact, Sacramento, California, which is in the middle of the state, is one of the cities that's most at risk from sea level rise because of this backup of water through the Delta region.
Bizarre to think about, really. So Dr. James Hansen, he's the former head of NASA's Goddard Space Center, the person who really warned us about climate change back in 1988. He is now saying we face several meters, more than 9 feet higher seas by the end of this century. That sounds incredible. What do you think?
Well, that paper is very controversial. You know, a lot of scientists have been working hard to are skeptical of it. Jim Hansen, I've spoken with him many times and have a huge amount of respect for him. And he's one of the few scientists that are sort of willing to go out there and kind of talk openly and publish openly about science that is sort of on, you know, the sort of real forefronts and are more speculative than what other scientists feel comfortable with. And, you know, Jim Hansen has often been proven right about this stuff. So I'm certainly not going to say that, you know, I just think that those numbers have to be proven out. But you don't even have to go that far. I mean, even NOAA, the top science agency, government science agency in the United States, is talking about a high end of 7 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. And, of course, it doesn't stop there. The end of the century is just one marker. It will continue to rise for centuries after that. So, you know, and one of the things that's really important about sea level rise to grasp is that, unlike other impacts of climate change, it's a sure thing. We know that even if we cut carbon emissions right now, go to zero right now, we can affect the long-term trajectory of sea level rise, but there's so much heat already built up in the oceans, and there's so much inertia that the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are going to melt, and we're going to have sea level rise. So it's something we have to prepare for.
You know, it's interesting on the Hansen thing. I just interviewed Pankaj Khanna from Rice University in Texas. They were looking at coral reefs that had been going extinct over periods of time, and they were able to find out that, in fact, sea level rise doesn't or didn't in the past happen in slow little increments the way the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change always shows them on the graphs, but in fact went up like a meter or even 2 meters in a decade to two decades. That happened in the past and the corals just drowned. So, you know, there's some strange things that are possible, and I think we need to talk about what is possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, again, a really important point that people think of sea level rise as this long, slow, gradual thing that, you know, maybe their grandchildren have to worry about or something like that, but and it moves in this slow curve. But in fact, our geologic past shows us that sea levels have risen in these very dramatic pulses. One period, 125,000 years ago, sea levels rose 13 feet in a single century. That's over a foot a decade, which if we got anything like that in our world right now, it would, of course, be devastating, totally devastating to coastal cities around the world. And the big question for geologists is, what was the mechanism that caused that? How did we get to these big pulses? And, you know, one of the things they're looking at is the instability of the big ice sheets in West Antarctica, which are situated on the sort of bowl at the edge of West Antarctica. And there's more and more evidence that, you know, these huge ice sheets, which some of which are 2 miles thick, could actually begin to kind of collapse into the sea at a very rapid rate. And because of the geology there, it's very different than it is in Greenland. And a number of scientists are beginning to think that these ice sheets in West Antarctica may have been what triggered some of these big pulses in sea level rise before and could do it again.
And scientists and policy experts talk about a global mean rise in sea levels. But, Jeff, is it going to be evenly distributed, like a fair dose for everybody?
No, it's not. That's, again, another really great point. So people think of sea level rise when, and, you know, I talk about these numbers of 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, whatever that is, as if it's just a bathtub that's filling up. But it's not. The sea level rise is, in fact, incredibly variable in different regions. There are a number of reasons for that. One has to do with something called glacial rebound. Some areas in some continents that were covered with ice during the last ice age are still, in fact, kind of rebounding, rising in the same way that, like, the couch rises after you take your hand off the couch. It takes a while for the foam to spring back. Continents are sort of like that. So in places like, say, Finland, for example, there's actually the sea levels are falling because the ground is rising so fast as a result of the pulling away of the weight of the ice sheets. But another really important factor is something called gravitational fingerprinting, which sounds very complicated, but really isn't. The two big ice sheets, ice masses on the planet, the one in the north in Greenland and the one in the south in Antarctica, have their own kind of gravitational force, and they, in effect, pull the water towards them. And as these ice sheets begin to melt and they lose mass, they, in fact, that gravitational force declines, and it actually has the effect of pushing water towards the opposite hemisphere. So if you live in New York or Boston and Antarctica melts, as Antarctica melts, you're going to get about 30% more sea level rise than you would if you were in South America. And ditto with the vice versa with Greenland. As Greenland melts, you're going to get about 30% greater sea level rise in South America than you are in, say, Boston or New York. So depending on where you live and what your, you know, where the ice melts first and how quickly that area melts will have a big impact on your local coastal scene.
Right. It gets wild. There was new science in the journal Science Advances in November 2017, and Eric LaRue et al. Say that specific ice masses will affect specific cities, and they say maybe coastal planners should look at where the ice is melting to see what's going to happen to them. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. My name is Alex Smith. Our guest is Jeff Goodall, author of the new book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Jeff, let's talk about some cities facing a slow extinction. Talk to us, what's going on in Miami?
Well, Miami's the sort of poster child for a city at risk with sea level rise, and it's in fact my visit there after Hurricane Sandy. I was in New York during Hurricane Sandy and, you know, saw the water that came into New York. And there was about 9 feet of storm surge in lower Manhattan. And a scientist I was talking to said, well, you know, think of this as a sort of dress rehearsal for sea level rise. You know, imagine that 9 feet of water coming in and never going out. And that's what sea level rise will be like. And he said, if you really want to, you know, think about this, go have that same thought exercise down in Miami. And so I did, and I happened to be down there in King Tides, where there are already parts of Miami Beach are, you know, were 3 feet, getting 3 feet of seawater into the streets. And it really became clear to me that, you know, in a world of rapidly rising seas, Miami's in big trouble. And it's in big trouble for very simple and obvious reasons. One is you have a whole lot of very expensive real estate right on the beach and right in the lowest areas of the city. And Miami's economy is basically built around real estate. So as that begins to falter, that's a big economic problem for the region. Secondly, it's all very low. Most of Miami-Dade County is less than 6 feet above sea level. So you have basically nowhere high to go to. You know, cities like New York have Washington Heights, places to retreat to that are high ground. You know, obviously, places like Seattle have high ground. Miami, there is no high ground. And the last thing that makes it be in trouble is the fact that it's built on basically Swiss cheese. The limestone that is beneath much of Miami is a particular kind of limestone that has a lot of holes in it, and the water will sort of go right through that. So what that means is you can't really build seawalls in the same way that you can in other areas because the water will just go right underneath the seawalls. So it's basically indefensible, even if you wanted to defend it. And that makes it a city that, you know, really has a kind of ticking clock going behind it.
From your research, Jeff Goodall, would you say more megacities are at risk in the subtropics than in the temperate zones where most of my listeners are now?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously you can tell which cities are at risk simply. The sea level rise is a very simple equation. I mean, it's all about elevation. And so cities that are low and are built on with a lot of fill are the ones that are most at risk. And those, I would guess, tend to be sort of more in the tropics area than in the far north or south. But there's so much fill area in many modern cities that Boston and New York are good examples. But, you know, also a number of European cities. So I think, you know, Jakarta, places like that are hugely at risk because they're subsiding. You have a number of cities in China, including Shanghai, that are hugely at risk. So it's really distributed around the globe.
Are the Chinese making plans to handle sea level rise?
Unfortunately, I was not able to sort of, I didn't write a lot about kind of what China is doing on this because, you know, I've been to China a number of times. There was this, so much, you know, I was trying to get a sense of this from a global point of view, and there was only so many places I could go.
Did you mention that you'd done some work on rising seas and the impacts on Africa?
Yes, I went to Lagos, to Nigeria, and spent a good deal of time there. And it was very interesting for two reasons. One is that I spent a couple of weeks living in these what are called water slums in Lagos, where about 500,000 people live in essentially what is a lagoon behind the city. And from there, these people live on these, you know, kind of homes that are built on poles out in the water. And, you know, they travel by boat. And after spending a couple of weeks there, it became very clear to me that the problem for sea level rise is that we've built all this infrastructure right on the coast that can't be moved. You talk to these people who live in these Lego slums about sea level rise, and they're like, we don't care. The water goes up 2 or 3 feet. We just build our houses. We just put our houses up a little bit higher. We can do it in a couple of days, and, you know, it's no problem. So that was very instructive to me. The other thing that's happening there is that they're sort of building this sort of what they call the Dubai of Africa, this landfill kind of extension of the coast that is 30 feet high above the seas, defended by, you know, this elaborate structure of riprock and other coastal defense things. It's essentially going to be a kind of fortress from the sea and from other kinds of intrusions in the city of Lagos, which is, I call the chapter Climate Apartheid, because you're really getting a sense of the people who, if you have money and the wherewithal to live in a place like this newly built island, you will be protected and you will be okay. If you are like everybody else, you will not be. You'll be outside the walls and you will be vulnerable. So it was very revealing to me, that trip, in a couple of ways.
Jeff, I wonder how you see the process of a city withdrawing from the sea over time. What happens when their major infrastructure like electric plants, airports, highways, subways, hospitals go under?
You know, that's, you know, the $65 billion question. It's hard to know how that will play out. But I think you put your finger on a really important point, which is that a lot of people think, you know, I'll deal with even places like Miami and Florida right now, and Fort Lauderdale right now. You have a lot of people who say, oh, you know, I'll add another foot to my seawall and I'm elevating my house, you know, 4 feet, and I'm going to be okay. And you're not going to be okay, because it's not going to do you any good to have an elevated house if you can't get to your house because the roads are flooded and the economy takes a dive because the airplane is shut down a lot of the time and you have electrical problems and things like that, drinking water problems. So the larger kind of infrastructure around this and the risk to that and how airports will be moved, how cities will begin to, you know, retreat to higher ground and what the economic implications of that are very problematic. And there's certainly going to have to be a lot of relocation. How that will play out, whether it will be, you know, as one person in my book said, a kind of, you know, smart managed retreat, or a kind of Mad Max scenario of just kind of chaos and economic losses and devastation, you know, I don't know. But this being America and how we usually do things, I can kind of guess that the Mad Max scenario is going to win out. But that is the big question about how we will deal with infrastructure.
Well, James Hansen said that rising seas could make some parts of the world ungovernable.
Well, I think that's certainly true. I mean, I think that, you know, as you see parts of, you know, just to take, not to pick on Southern Florida, but it's such an obvious example, you know, as the seas move in there, you can it's pretty obvious that the conventional kind of governing structures are going to have a hard time keeping up. The parts of the cities will have to be abandoned. What will happen in those abandoned areas, whether, you know, who will move in, what kind of politics that will cause. You know, you're going to have a lot of refugees. And Puerto Rico is just a modest example. You had, obviously, Hurricane Maria came through there and devastated Puerto Rico, and now there's 140,000 or so refugees who have moved to the mainland in Florida. And just that small amount is going to change the sort of politics of that state in a big way. And when you start to think about the kind of dislocation you're going to have as seas rise, I mean, one recent study that I read predicted 2.5 million people displaced in Florida by the end of the century. And that's politically, that's a seismic event. And so how that will play out is anyone's guess.
Yeah, it's going to be huge, just like the immigration into Europe. The millions that went to Europe in 2017 will be nothing compared to that, I guess. And but speaking of worthless real estate, I'm hoping that eventually there will be a giant monolith, big stone pillar erected on Trump's Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach as a symbol of dangerous lunacy of climate denial.
I love that idea. That's a fabulous idea.
And you could just keep marking the higher sea levels as they go up, and that's how stupid it was. Say, Jeff Goodall, in 2014, you interviewed Microsoft founder Bill Gates for Rolling Stone magazine. Was he aware of the mega threat of climate change?
Yeah, he certainly is, and he certainly was even at that time. I think that Bill has a he's a technological optimist, you know, and so he believes that, you know, we're going to find kind of clean energy solutions sooner rather than later. He's a big believer in investment, basic research on energy. He himself is funding a lot of research. He's a big believer in sort of new generation nuclear power. And, you know, I think that Bill is, I think he grasped the complexity of all this and the urgency of it. I think he's been pretty outspoken about it. But I do think that he's on the technological optimist side of all this. And he doesn't dwell a lot on the sort of darker side of some of the climate impacts, but more on the urgency of doing something to kind of, you know, displace fossil fuels.
Yeah, it's wild. He is spending a lot of money to help people in the developing world with diseases and basic things like immunization, and good for him. I mean, it's wonderful that he and Melinda have done that. But on the other hand, climate change is going to make those people's lives a living hell anyway. So I want to let that go, though. The Dutch have been leaders in sea level control. Do you think the Netherlands can survive what is coming?
Well, according to people in the Netherlands, you know, they, you know, I spent a lot of time there, and you know, they've done, obviously, been thinking about living with water for, you know, 1,000 years or more, and their entire kind of governance structure and legal structure of their of the Netherlands is built around thinking about water. So they have a lot of not only kind of experience, but kind of capacity for dealing with this in ways that we don't. I mean, we have property rights and things like that are a huge issue that are going to stall a lot of kind of coastal defenses and any kind of changing about how we live on the coast. And they don't have those sorts of problems. But, you know, 30% of the country right now is below sea level. And as the waters rise, they're very well aware of the fact that these dikes and walls and other kind of barrier structures that they've erected to keep their nation dry are not going to work. You can't just keep building higher and higher walls. So they're basically coming up, you know, beginning to think in a different way about it. They have this notion of what they call living with water, encouraging development in ways that encourage floating cities, floating houses, just beginning a kind of transition away from, essentially away from dry land and from thinking that they have to keep their entire nation kind of dry and that they won't be able to. And so how do you live with water in a kind of controlled and peaceable way? And I think that's, they understand, is their future.
I know that London is building new higher tide gates on the Thames, trying to keep back rising seas. But I have talked to people in Britain who realize that the British Houses of Parliament will not be usable in the year 2200. They will be underwater, and they seem rather ready to accept that. I wonder if there is a kind of ready to accept that feeling in many parts of the world now.
No, I don't think that there's a, you know, I think it's one thing to think about being ready to accept something, you know, that's going to be 100 years out, because it's pretty abstract. I'm trying to think if there's anywhere that I've been that, you know, I think for governance and for political bodies, for political leaders, the idea of giving up ground, of giving up not only just, you know, populace and people, but also just actual territory is a very, very difficult concept to embrace. And it will have to be embraced, because one scientist said when I was reporting my book, you know, you never want to fight a war with water because water always wins. And water will win in this, you know, there'll be no coastal defenses that will really keep it away eventually. And places will lose populace, they will lose tax base, they will shrink, they will go away. But how fast that process happens is what's really up in the air right now. And I don't know any political figure or leader in any nation that is, you know, willing to embrace that, except in some ways the Pacific Islands understand that they have to make a home somewhere else. I mean, they're the closest that I can say to actually embracing this idea that their land, their nation, their home, their identities are going to be subsumed by the water, and are beginning to think about what that means and where they will go and how they will live and how they will preserve what they have left.
Some have made an agreement to go to New Zealand, and they've already been over there kind of looking around and laying the groundwork, saying, well, how could we live here?
Yeah, and the people of Kiribati have purchased and been given some number, I think it's 800 acres on Fiji, highland on Fiji, to relocate there. But, you know, this is all good, having a place to go in that sense. The Marshall Islanders have a thing called the Compact of Free Association with the United States that allows them to come to the United States. From my book, I went to Springdale, Arkansas, where there's a huge population of Marshall Islanders who work at the chicken plants there, and spent some time with there and talked to them about the losses of their, what it means to lose their nation, you know, as well as going to the Marshall Islands themselves. But, you know, these refuges and places to go are great, but they're not the same thing. I mean, obviously, it's very problematic in very many ways, and I don't know that there's any other solution. But talking to Marshall Islanders now, you feel the grief already, and you feel that sort of sense of loss and the knowing what's going to happen. And I think that kind of psychological mourning is what a lot of people who live on coasts are going to be very soon facing.
It's heartbreaking, and I think there's kind of an international crime involved, but we can't dive into that in this interview. We're starting to wrap up. And as we do, I'm wondering, do you have any ideas on how the public can get involved in starting to prepare and to fight for lower carbon emissions before we go under?
Well, again, that's the big question. I mean, that's been the question for 30 years, you know, and we keep having moments of hope combined and then followed by moments of, you know, regression. So I was in Paris during when the Paris Accord was signed, and all the nations of the world basically signed to that. And it felt to me like a very hopeful and optimistic moment. And I really believed that kind of we had turned the corner and beginning to take this seriously. And then everyone knows what happened. We have the Trump administration, you know, who's done everything they can to undermine this, to undermine the international leadership on this, to claim that this is not real, to erase the climate data, to promote fossil fuels. So it's very hard to see what will drive this. I mean, I think ultimately economics are going to drive this, in the sense of cheaper, cleaner energy, declining real estate prices on the coast are going to force people to leave and to sell where they live, to get out of there. But to really solve this and to, you know, to cut carbon emissions to the degree that we need to, it's really a political, and we need, you know, the political leadership that we just simply don't have globally or obviously in the United States. So what people can do, I think, is just get involved politically on every level, making awareness of climate change, cutting carbon emissions the number one issue that they vote on, being outspoken about it, talking to friends about it, and doing everything they can to kind of foment political action on this issue.
Jeff, do you have a website where people can find you, and what is your Twitter feed?
I don't have a website, really. I kind of gave that up a few years ago, but my Twitter feed is just my name, Jeff Goodell, at Jeff Goodell, and people can find me there. I'm on Facebook, and a simple Google search will turn up a lot of my articles and interviews and things like that.
Okay, and I'll put some links to some of your work in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and of course, to your new book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. It's available from all the usual sources. Jeff, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You have seen graphs of warming as carbon grows in the atmosphere, but new research suggests all carbon is not equal. My weak non-scientific understanding is that maybe each unit of CO2 becomes more damaging to the climate as the decades progress. If true, that could change the whole game, but I need help to understand this. We will explore the new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on November 28th. The lead author is Paolo Seppi. He's a postdoctoral research assistant with a lot of scientific papers to his credit at the Meteorology Unit, University of Reading, UK. Paolo, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your time. I appreciate it. And I often dig in with the paper abstract. It's a good way for beginners to start. And this one, though, is really dense and it's loaded. So let's try to deconstruct it a bit for the non-scientist. First off, what sort of climate feedbacks become smaller over time as CO2 increases in these climate models?
Feedbacks actually become more positive over time. And what this means is maybe the easiest example is the case of what we call the ice albedo feedback. So the fact that as the planet warms, sea ice melts, and therefore you're left with a darker sea surface that takes up more solar energy, and that leads to further warming in addition to the warming that was caused by CO2. So that's what we would call a positive feedback. And so what we see, and the subject of our paper, was that our climate models predict that under CO2 forcing, so as you increase CO2 levels, the feedbacks become gradually more positive over time, so they tend to amplify the CO2 forcing even more.
So why does the abstract say they become smaller over time? That's confusing to me.
So let's see. I think it's a bit confusing because there are different time conventions, different things we can look at. And so we said feedbacks become smaller in magnitude. So the total feedback is negative. Sorry, this is a bit technical. The total feedback is negative. That has to be the case for a system that doesn't have a runaway sort of greenhouse gas forcing. And this becomes less negative as time passes. So it becomes more positive, but closer to zero. Does that make some sense?
No, not yet. But are we talking about very long periods of time and eventually the feedbacks wind down? Is that what we're talking about?
So let's see. We're talking about periods of time of the order of decades to centuries. Let's see. So there are various climate feedbacks from different things, like, for example, from sea ice, from changes in cloud cover, changes in atmospheric water vapor, and so on. But the total feedback, so the sum of all these feedbacks, is a negative effect. But this becomes less negative as time passes, or more positive, and closer to zero. So if it can go from, for example, a value of -3 to -2, to give an example.
Okay, well, let's tackle this from another angle. I know that the troposphere is the lowest layer of Earth's atmosphere, and that's where we and the birds live and up to about the stratosphere. So you have written in that same abstract about tropospheric stability. Now, is that expected to become more stable, or when it changes, this is kind of a complicated question, but when it changes, does it shift to a new stable state or a more chaotic one?
So it's not about chaos, but it's about maybe a better way to put this is it's about the rates of warming in at the surface or near the surface and higher up in the atmosphere. So in general, the upper levels of the atmosphere warm faster than the surface for reasons that are pretty well understood that have to do with basic physics. But what we see in the models, what we show in our paper, is that as time passes under CO2 forcing, the upper levels of the atmosphere start to, the warming of the upper levels start to slow down relative to the surface warming. So the difference in warming rate starts decreasing. And this is what we refer to as the stability of the atmosphere. So the response of the atmosphere to CO2 becomes more unstable, so to speak, because the surface warming becomes a bit faster relative to the upper level warming. And this has effects on the amount of cloud cover that you have. So how much cloud cover changes, or how cloud properties change as the planet warms.
Okay, so let's get to really what the purpose of your paper is. And was I correct in my introduction in saying that a unit of carbon emitted later in time may actually have more impact on the Earth than a unit of carbon emitted now?
Yes and no. It's complicated, is the short answer. I would say no based on our paper. Our paper doesn't imply that, actually. Okay, so if you had CO2 increasing at a constant rate, our climate models would say that the warming would speed up. However, that's not because later units of carbon have a more negative or more negative impact or cause more warming, but it's because you have a delayed effect from the older emission of CO2, if that makes sense. So the response to the, if there's a time dependence, that means that later on you'll have more warming than you actually expect from the early response. Does that make some sense?
Yes. Well, I guess some of this boils down to what's called climate sensitivity, and
that's right.
Is based on what happens when the carbon amount doubles. Is that what climate sensitivity is about?
That's correct. So climate sensitivity is just a number that tells you how much surface temperature globally averaged increases for a doubling of atmospheric CO2.
And does that change, that climate sensitivity? Is it changing?
So the problem is we don't know what the climate sensitivity is because we don't have a doubling of CO2 yet. So we have to sort of extrapolate, use current relationships to estimate what it will be in the future at equilibrium. We don't expect to reach equilibrium warming because that takes centuries or millennia. Now, what we see in our climate models is that this estimated climate sensitivity actually goes up as time passes. So first you think the planet will warm only by, say, 3 degrees, but then you realize that the warming starts speeding up, and so then your final estimate of equilibrium warming starts going up. And so basically all our climate models, with very few exceptions, all our complex climate models predict this estimated climate sensitivity value will tend to go up as time passes, assuming CO2 continues increasing.
So my reading of your work, part of what Paolo Seppi does is to look at various climate models that have very different results and try and figure out why those results are different, and maybe even make some suggestions on how they could be harmonized or straightened out. Is that an accurate reading of some of what you do?
In general, yes. In general, there's a lot of differences between our models. So in particular, this climate sensitivity metric that we talked about varies a lot between models. So all our models agree that the planet will warm as CO2 levels increase, but the estimated value of climate sensitivity varies by a factor of more than 2 between the most sensitive climate model and the least sensitive climate model. So I would say in general, in climate science, and particularly my work also deals with trying to narrow down the range of model outcomes, particularly using observations or using understanding of the physical processes to come up with less uncertain estimates of climate change, sort of more quantitative estimates of how the climate will respond to CO2 forcing.
Well, now here's something I'm worried about, and it's not just me, and that is that climate models may be underestimating what we're really heading into. And there's a brand new paper out by Ken Caldera and Patrick Brown saying exactly that measurements of reality show that so far the climate models have been predicting less than what we're experiencing, and that might mean we will have a more extreme future. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I haven't read that paper in detail because it came out only yesterday. My understanding is it's just one line of evidence. So they use some sort of method to weight the models, the climate models, based on how well they represent certain aspects of current climate. in order to narrow down the range of uncertainty for future warming predictions. So, and yes, indeed, they say that it seems that the better models actually predict higher warming than we expect currently. It's still very difficult, actually, to narrow the range of predictions. I think there's several lines of evidence. So that paper you just mentioned, but also other papers using different methods, either using observational constraints or using a better understanding of the physics. So various papers have been saying that probably the future warming or climate sensitivity will be more towards the upper end of the range of predictions that we have. So as a reminder, the last IPCC report, so the report on by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has a range of climate sensitivity between 1.5 and 4.5. That's the most likely range.
And that's a big range, and it makes a big difference about how fast and how much governments should be doing to save us from climate change.
Yeah, one reason why we care about this climate sensitivity metric is because it's one of the most fundamental ways to measure climate change. It's just a very simple question, right? I mean, you put a certain amount of CO2, how much does the planet warm? And we expect a lot of the impacts of climate change to scale with global warming. So that's why a lot of policy decisions are based on this.
And Paulo, you're also a cloud specialist, are you?
That's right. I mean, yes, I've done work on that.
And there's been a lot of discussion about whether a warmer world will have more or fewer clouds. And if there were more clouds, that might provide a break on warming by deflecting more sunlight, maybe. What are your thoughts on that question?
Yes, so what you're referring to is what we call the cloud feedback. So, for example, how much cloud cover will change with warming, will determine how much warming we get. And actually, maybe the reason why, just to, this is a bit of a digression, but the reason why we care so much about this cloud feedback is because it's actually the main reason why different climate models give different climate sensitivity estimates, is because they disagree on how clouds will respond to warming. Of course, we might hope that clouds respond in a way such as to slow down or reduce the warming, which would be a negative feedback. But actually, the majority of climate models and also the best observational estimates we currently have tend to indicate that cloud feedback will most likely be positive, meaning that clouds will actually amplify global warming. And this is partly due to a predicted decrease in cloud cover in the tropics, which allows more sunlight to reach the surface. But it also has to do with how clouds interact with thermal or infrared radiation that the Earth tries to emit to space to cool itself down. So clouds also act a bit like greenhouse gases by trapping this radiation.
Okay, now I'm going to dive into something that I know nothing about, which is your 2016 paper, Negative Shortwave Feedback. And what is shortwave cloud feedback?
Yeah, so shortwave is our jargon for solar radiation. So a shortwave feedback is a feedback that affects how much solar radiation reaches the surface and can warm the climate. So in that paper, we were talking about a negative cloud feedback on solar radiation that happens in the high latitudes. So specifically, our climate models, at least, well, the vast majority of our climate models predict that in the high latitudes, so say from 50 degrees to the pole or so, clouds will become more reflective of sunlight and therefore will contribute to a local cooling effect with warming.
And then you also write somewhere else that we might expect a decrease in marine tropical low cloud as the planet warms. Why is that?
Yeah, so one thing I should say first maybe is, despite what I said about the high latitude negative cloud feedback, globally we expect cloud feedback to be positive, so that the globally averaged effect will be a warming effect, so to speak. And this is in large part because of what you just referred to, this low cloud decrease, which is expected to happen because the tropics take up a large part of the Earth's surface. And so the exact reasons for that positive tropical cloud feedback are still a matter of debate. It's very difficult to represent these clouds in climate models. And so actually, climate models disagree to a large extent on this specific aspect of the climate change response of clouds. But we're starting to have fairly good observational evidence thanks to satellite records that are becoming long enough. So we have reliable satellite records since roughly year 2000. And these records give us a global, you know, coverage of clouds and their effects on radiation. And they do show that when surface temperatures go up, the amount of clouds, and particularly low clouds, tends to decrease, and therefore allowing more solar radiation to reach the surface.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to the Radio EcoShock show. My guest from the University of Reading in the UK is Dr. Paolo Seppi. We're talking about clouds and more warming and climate, all stimulated by a new paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And Paolo, a few years ago, I talked several times with cloud expert Timothy Garrett at the University of Utah, and he told me that cloud science was one of the last unexplored frontiers in science. Because of the chaos and the difficulty of the study, it leaves a lot of questions, he said. What do you think?
Yes, I would agree with that. So I guess clouds are maybe the biggest challenge for our climate models. The problem is that climate models, you know, they do a fairly good job at representing current climate and its response to increasing greenhouse gases, but they really struggle with processes that happen on very small spatial scales. And clouds are very complex. They have, I mean, if you look at them, you know, if you look at the sky, clouds are very complex shapes. They come in all sorts of types at different heights, and they can be thick or they can be thin. And models really struggle realistically representing these clouds and the effect they have on radiation, which is what controls global warming, really. So as I was saying earlier, clouds are the main reason why climate models disagree on how much the planet will warm. This has been a problem for decades, and we're still working on improving the physical representation of the processes that are responsible for clouds.
I'd like to blunder into another topic that you've discussed, namely the baroclinicity of the atmosphere. Now, according to Wikipedia, a baroclinic atmosphere is one for which the density depends on both the temperature and the pressure. Contrast this with barotropic atmosphere, for which the density depends only on the pressure. So all I know about pressure and the atmosphere is probably comes from TV weathermen. So what is baroclinicity in the atmosphere, and does it matter?
Yeah, so this was in a different context. We were talking about atmospheric circulation. So baroclinicity is a property of the atmosphere that affects the circulation of the atmosphere. It's jargon, but what it refers to is basically, to put it the most simple way possible, is the temperature gradient between low and high latitudes, and that determines how strong the winds are in the middle latitudes and also how strong the storms are. And so, in the context of climate change, one thing we care about is how this baroclinicity, or how the temperature gradients between low and high latitudes, will evolve as the planet warms. Because that will determine how our storms change and how the jet stream position and variability will change, and this ultimately will affect our weather.
Okay, now, you've raised another question in my mind, and that is, scientist James Hansen warned that a more rapid ice melt on Greenland could weaken or deflect the Great Atlantic Current that warms Europe. I'm wondering, does something similar happen in the atmosphere? Are atmospheric currents already changing?
It's hard to say, mainly because the atmosphere is naturally very variable. So even if we already have a forcing, because greenhouse gases are increasing, but the signal due to the forcing is still relatively small compared with the amount of daily or monthly variability that naturally occurs. That being said, I think we already have some evidence that the currents in the atmosphere, or the circulation of the atmosphere, is changing or has changed. Maybe the best example for that is the effect of the ozone hole. So you may have heard of the Antarctic ozone hole, the fact that we have lost the ozone cover that we have in the lower stratosphere, so around 20 kilometers or so over the South Pole. This, in turn, is because of certain gases that have been emitted by industrial processes during the 20th century. And so this ozone hole has caused changes in in temperature over the polar cap over Antarctica, which in turn have had an effect on the southern hemispheric circulation. And that's something that we have both observational evidence for and also evidence from climate models. So we have several lines of evidence that show that human activities have already started changing the circulation of the atmosphere. And we expect that greenhouse gases will have similar effects on the atmospheric circulation, at least based on what models are telling us. But we don't yet have quite enough observational data to tell whether that's happening.
Yes, and you did some research on the southern hemisphere. I like that because we don't hear enough about it. And again, another question, we've heard about the winds tightening around Antarctica, which has changed the weather in Australia, and I might have expected the same thing to happen at the North Pole, but so far it seems to me that the jet stream has actually weakened with loops penetrating further south into the U.S. than expected instead of retreating towards the pole. What is going on?
Yeah, so the northern and southern hemispheres respond somewhat differently or change quite differently as the planet warms. And this is related to this baryclinicity we talked about earlier. So, for example, in the northern hemisphere, you have a lot of warming over the Arctic region because you lose sea ice there. So you have a lot of, you know, warming at high latitudes, and that changes the temperature gradient between the high latitudes and the lower latitudes. And that, in turn may have an effect on mid-latitude winds and circulation. Whereas in the southern hemisphere, you actually, the north to south gradients, temperature gradients change in quite different ways. And you have less warming at high latitudes because Antarctica is just staying where it is. You will still have a nice sheet there for quite a while. So that's also why we expect the atmospheric circulation to change in pretty different ways in the southern hemisphere compared with the northern hemisphere. Now, what you referred to with the sort of waviness of the jet stream and the cold and hot spells that we may have in middle latitude regions and the link to temperature gradients, that's still pretty debated in the community. So there really isn't enough observational evidence, I would say, to tell whether there is an impact from global warming on the circulation in the northern hemisphere.
You were the lead author of a paper titled Fast and Slow Components of Extratropical Atmospheric Circulation Response to CO2 Forcing. Can you give us a brief glimpse into what those fast and slow responses are?
Sure, I can try. So essentially, we were looking at how the climate system responds to CO2 increases at various timescales. And this is easiest to understand in somewhat idealized, somewhat simplified experiments where you increase CO2 all at once, and then you allow the climate system to respond to this forcing. And what we see is that there are various timescales. We highlighted two timescales that we call fast and slow. So the fast being on the order of one decade, slow being on the order of one century or several centuries. And so these two timescales of climate change have very different properties, or the climate changes in very different ways, especially atmospheric circulation, which is what we were looking at in that paper. And so we showed that most of the atmospheric circulation changes that are relevant to the middle to high latitudes, so regions like where you live in Vancouver, for example, those changes happen on the fast timescale. So they happen within a few years of the increase in CO2. And so that's something that is useful to know if we're interested in the long-term impacts of increasing greenhouse gases, because it tells us that at least for mid-latitude circulation, most of these impacts might happen quite soon after the CO2 increase.
Let's return to your newest paper. And a press summary says the influence of increasing levels of atmospheric CO2 on global warming will become more severe over time. Now, that's probably the take-home and a very important point. Would you talk to us about that?
Yes. So in this paper, we were trying to explain why. So if our climate models say that if greenhouse gases increase at a constant rate, temperature will or global warming will start speeding up. So this has to do with how climate feedback, so for example, how clouds change as the planet warms. And our climate models are saying that, for example, the cloud feedback will become more and more positive as warming proceeds. So that's what was the subject of this paper. We were trying to provide a mechanism for why this change in the climate feedbacks happens in our climate models.
Well, I can see how your conclusions are important to help climate modelers, and you have a history of analyzing and testing models, as I said, but it also sounds to me like a very dangerous finding for all of us trapped here in a warming reality. What do you think?
Yes, so I think there are several implications. One important implication from this study, I think, is it tells us something about what we can learn from recent climate change in order to infer things about future long-term climate change. So what our paper shows, for example, is that because climate feedbacks increase over time, if we use present-day or recent climate change observations to infer long-term warming, we may actually underestimate the long-term warming because we are using information based on the present-day feedbacks, which are less warming than the future feedbacks. And so this understanding actually helps us to reconcile observational estimates of future warming with what the climate models are telling us, because we're looking actually at different timescales in the observations versus the climate models.
And that stimulates another idea in me, and that is that the general scenario proposed by governments is that carbon emissions will peak at some point and then gradually reduce as we convert away from fossil fuels. I find that idea dangerous on the face of it, but even if we accept that, it sounds like the tail of emissions while we decarbonize could be more dangerous than we thought. Is that a reasonable reading from your paper?
Not directly from our paper, actually. So our paper doesn't imply that a future unit of CO2 will itself cause more warming, although there are other lines of evidence, not from our paper, that do suggest that at high levels of CO2, every unit of CO2 will become a bit more harmful, if you like, or will cause more warming. But that's slightly different from what we talk about in our paper. What our paper actually says is one unit of CO2 emission now, its effect will actually be amplified later on because of timescales that are intrinsic to the climate system, delayed responses, if you like. And so this has to do with these feedbacks becoming more positive later on. So if I put an extra unit of CO2 now, you will have, for example, a change in cloud cover to the warming caused by the CO2. But then later on in time, clouds will start responding in a different way, which will start amplifying this warming.
You know, I finally understood your paper.
I'm glad.
From the UK, we've been talking with Dr. Paolo Seppi, a postdoctoral research assistant and prodigious scientific digger at the Meteorology Unit, University of Reading. You can find links to Paolo's webpage and the science we've talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. The paper's title is Relationship of Tropospheric Stability to Climate Sensitivity and Earth's Observed Radiation Budget. Paolo, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks to you. It was my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.